like to thank the organizers for putting this together and inviting me to talk. What looks like it's going to be a really exciting conference. So, historically, there's been an important back and forth between condensed matter and particle physics. And I think a lot of us are hoping that that will continue long into the future. Since this is a conference for high energy physicists thinking about low energy physics, I'm going to have quite a bit of background slides. So if you're an expert on this, please just bear with me. And I should mention this is a subject which there's still a lot that I'm learning about it. So if you think I'm glossing over some important subtlety, or you think I'm not emphasizing some point sufficiently, then please feel free to add your comments. So let me just jump right into it. This is a talk about non-Fermi liquids, and I'll tell you what that means, but I'm going to start with Fermi liquids, which is the theory of sort of simple metals, the sort of metals you know and love. When you think of metals like copper, this is the description. This goes back to Landau from almost half a century ago. And the biggest, sort of most important dynamical difference when you deal with metals is, as opposed to in particle physics, where you're usually thinking about physics of a vacuum, here we're thinking about physics in the background of some finite density of fermions. And as Pauli taught us long ago, when you take a bunch of fermions and put them in one place, even at zero temperature, they don't all fall into the ground state. Rather, because of Pauli exclusion, they fill up the lowest energy levels, then the next lowest energy level, and then so on, and so forth, and all the way out to some finite valence energy known as the Fermi surface. And this Fermi surface has some large value of momentum associated with it, known as the Fermi momentum. And as a result, the low energy excitations around this background look fairly different from the vacuum. There are these things which look like particle hole excitations. The reason is, for very low energy costs, you can go in, you can pick out one of the fermions from right below the Fermi surface, and you can lift it to just above the Fermi surface, and that costs you very little energy. However, the particles in the holes both carry this large momentum associated with the Fermi surface itself. So the description of these guys in most metals that Landau set forth half a century ago is that, to leading approximation, these particle hole excitations are just non-interacting. Okay, they just travel freely through the metal with only very weak interactions. And one of the ways of sort of quantifying that is their decay width is very small. In particular, their decay width goes like energy squared. So as you go to lower and lower energies, you get smaller and smaller, and they look to better and better approximation, just like freely traveling particles. Okay? And when Landau first proposed this, this was something of a mystery, because you have this electron traveling through a metal with tons of other electrons around. They're all interacting with each other. Why is it that it should behave as if there are no interactions at all? And there's this modern effective field theory way of understanding this, which, to my knowledge, was first sort of written down by Shanker and then elaborated on by Polchinski. And the explanation is very simple. If you just look at the field theory of fermions on the Fermi surface, essentially all interactions are irrelevant. And so that means, as you go to low and lower energies, they're going to become less and less important. You eventually end up at low energies in the free theory. So there's an important caveat here, which I'll talk about, which is physically very interesting. But I'm going to go through this argument, since it's nice and important, and it'll also be useful for setting up the scaling, which I'll then use when I go away from the Fermi liquid description. So how do we do scaling when we have a Fermi surface? So there's an important difference from what we're used to. In the vacuum, as you go to low energy, you're scaling towards the origin in momentum space. Okay? Now, once you have a finite density, that's no longer the case. Now, the space of zero energy is not a point of the origin, but rather it's this Fermi surface. And so as you scale to low energies, you want to scale towards the surface. And there are different ways of doing this, but the one I personally find conceptually to be the simplest is the one that Polchinski used in his first paper on the subject, which is as following. So for any momentum you have, just fix the direction of that momentum. And then to scale into the infrared, just scale down the normal component of that vector. Okay, so there's some large component which sits right on the Fermi surface, and then there's some normal piece. Keep the angle fixed and just scale this down as you scale energy down. Okay. And so in this scaling, angles are not playing an important role, and you can, to some extent, think of the Fermi surface being a continuum of coupled 1 plus 1 dimensional fermions. Okay. So now let's be a little more technically precise about that. So here I've written the quadratic action. Here's the integral over angles, which isn't really playing an important role in this. And now I've written the kinetic term in momentum space. So we have an energy and a energy integral and a momentum integral for the normal component. And then we have the kinetic term itself. And it's easy to see there are 1, 2, 3 factors of energy here. And so to keep this whole thing invariant, as you scale, you want the fermions to scale like -3/2 power. Okay? And this is true in basically any dimension. So, okay, now we can move on to do something interesting. We can look at how interactions scale. And just like in relativistic physics, the lowest dimension interaction, if all the only fields you have are fermions, is a 4-fermion interaction. And this, by going through the scaling, one sees that is for almost all interactions, turns out to be irrelevant. So actually, we can just go through this. It's very simple. We have, for each fermion, we have an energy and a momentum integral. So that gives us a total of 8. There's -1 for the frequency delta function. So now we're down to 7. Each fermion carries a power of -3/2. So altogether, that's -6. So now we're down to 1. And we're left over with 1 total factor of energy. And so this whole thing scales like energy and is irrelevant. Okay. Now, a key point of that was I didn't scale this momentum conserving delta function. However, there's an important caveat. So the reason for that is if you just choose sort of 4 random angles, they're all going to be mostly pointing on the Fermi surface. So they're going to be just a sum of 4 big momenta. And that, even as you scale all the way into the infrared, is not going to scale anymore. It's just going to be some fixed number. However, the important caveat is there are special kinematic configurations where all 4 of these large components sum up to 0. Okay, they exactly cancel. And then when that happens, you get a cancellation of these guys. There's one, now you get to see the scaling of the normal component, and this scale is like -1, and now the whole interaction becomes marginal. Okay? So the most important of these configurations where everything cancels is the channel where you have 2 guys coming in exactly back to back, scatter to 2 guys scattering exactly back to back. Okay, so these marginal interactions are classically marginal, and so as we're used to, the next step is to then do loop calculation and see what the running is to figure out if they're marginally relevant or marginally irrelevant. Yes?
Sorry, in the previous slides, you choose the particular dimension of space?
You do, it doesn't really affect the answer, but yes. So the dimension of space is just here, it's just the number of the angle, dimension of the angles.
So the scaling dimension of the operator should depend on the space dimension?
Usually it does, but in this case, it actually doesn't. So this is in any dimension, and it's because the angles aren't scaling. So you're really only seeing the energy in the normal component. Okay. So this is a little different from what we're used to. This turns out to be classically marginal in any number of dimensions. All right, so you do some one-loop calculation. This is a fairly straightforward calculation. It's a standard thing in the literature, and as you would guess, based on it, the interaction being classically marginal, there's a log divergence. So the beta function goes like the coupling squared. And this very simple result has important implications. So basically, from this, you see the BCS instability. So to see how this happens, we can just look at the beta function. So the beta function is v squared, so it's always positive. So let's ask what happens first at positive values of the coupling. So I've chosen conventions here. So positive value corresponds to repulsive. So the beta function is positive. So as you go to low energies, the coupling is getting smaller. And so you're flowing to 0. And so in that case, even this one interaction, which could have become, which was classically marginal, it's marginally irrelevant. And so as you go into the infrared, it just becomes weaker and weaker. And you eventually get to a free theory. However, the story is very different if you have an attractive interaction. So if at any point this coupling is attractive, now you start on this side, and now we can go through the same type of argument. Again, the beta function is still positive, so you're still getting smaller as you go into the infrared, but now smaller means you're going from like -1 to -10. So the coupling is actually getting bigger in terms of magnitude. And so as you flow into the infrared, it gets bigger and bigger, eventually it runs away, you hit a lambda pole. At that point, you get pairing of the fermions into Cooper pairs, you get the BCS instability, so the scalar that forms gets Higgs, you get superconductivity, and the rest of that story comes out. So this is sort of the simple field theory way of understanding BCS instability. I think it's a very beautiful application of field theory, and it maybe makes sense to include this in when we teach our graduate students about quantum field theory, just to see this as a really emphasizing the sort of general applicability of field theory to a wide range of subjects. So that I'm almost done talking about Fermi liquids, but there's one more important qualitative point I want to make before moving on to non-Fermi liquids, which is something that's known as the Yaffe-Regel limit, sometimes called the Mott-Yaffe-Regel limit. And this is basically a bound on how large resistivity can be in simple metals. And to understand it, you first start with a relation you probably learned back in high school, which is the relation between the resistivity in a metal and the mean free path of the electrons. Okay, so the idea is very simple. It's sort of a cartoonish picture. If you take a metal and you turn on an electric field, the electrons are going to start accelerating. They're going to accelerate sort of freely for about one mean free path. After that point, they'll hit something, they'll ricochet off in some random direction, and now they have to start all over, okay? And so the longer the mean free path is, the longer they get to travel, the more they get to accelerate before they have to start all over. So as a result, the resistivity ends up being inversely proportional to the mean free path, okay? And so what this says is if your resistivity is very large, then your mean free path is very short. And the Yaffe-Regel limit just says if the mean free path is so short that it's shorter than the lattice spacing, then at that point you couldn't have a good quasi-particle description anymore. Okay? And indeed, most good metals do satisfy this limit. So what happens is you start at very low temperatures, the resistivity is very small, you crank that up. As you crank the temperature up, the resistivity gets larger and larger, and eventually it tends to saturate around this limit. Okay? Now, the reason I bring this up is because there are a lot of materials which violate this. You increase the temperature, and the resistivity goes right on past this limit. Okay, and this is an indication that these materials don't have a quasi-particle description. Okay, and I like this because it's sort of a very visceral, intuitive way of understanding why some materials shouldn't have a quasi-particle description. All right. And so this is one of many characteristics that materials known as non-Fermi liquids have. This is actually a large class of materials, with some of them with quite different properties. But some of the generic things that are seen on them are, first of all, resistivity, which is linear in temperature. Many of them violate this Yaffe-Regel bound. We often see superconductivity in them occurring at a very high temperature. And finally, the last point, which will be crucial for this talk, is they're often located near what are known as quantum critical points. Okay, so quantum critical points are a fairly simple idea. It's just phase transitions that occur at zero temperature. So here I've shown some experimental plot, which is capturing this. So here we have on the y-axis temperature, and on the x-axis we have some control parameter. And up in this orange region, there's some non-Fermi liquid behavior. But what I want to draw your attention to is the x-axis. So here at zero temperature, as we change the control parameter, we go from the ordered phase to the disordered phase. Right? And there's some finite value where that transition occurs. And this is what's known as the quantum critical point. It's called a quantum critical point or quantum phase transition because it's happening at zero temperature. So it's being driven by quantum fluctuations rather than thermal fluctuations. Okay. And so the cartoon of these materials is that we have some diagram like this. There's a quantum critical point at zero temperature, and then there's a pizza wedge region that sort of emanates from it where there's some non-Fermi liquid behavior. Okay? And one of the things that people suspect is that this non-Fermi liquid region is actually associated with this quantum critical point. So let me give you a very simple reason for why you might expect that to be true. Let me go to discuss this. Let me go back to Landau's other major achievement, Landau-Ginzburg theory. So he taught us that we could learn an enormous amount about phase transitions just by writing down the Lagrangian for the order parameter of the phase transition itself. Okay. So for instance, if we're studying ferromagnetism, this would be something like the magnetization. And the point is, already just by looking at the potential for this field, you can describe whether or not a phase transition occurs. If the mass squared at the origin is negative, then it's concave down, and so you roll away and get a VEV. Or if the mass squared is positive, then you're stabilized at the origin. And so for a first order phase transition or weakly second order, then the phase transition itself happens at approximately zero mass. So a quantum critical point is associated with an approximately massless scalar field. And what's special about this pizza wedge region is that the mass squared is less than the temperature, okay? So at energies of order of the temperature, this looks like we just have a massless boson around. So we have a new degree of freedom in our effective theory. All right, so this is the field content we want to understand. So as a high-energy physicist, I'm going to take some lessons from the study of QCD in my approach to this problem. So the first lesson was that when people were studying deep inelastic scattering, people were confused. It wasn't clear what field theories could possibly explain this, what they were seeing. In fact, many people claimed that there were no field theories that could possibly explain that was going on. This included, in fact, I think Wilson actually wrote a paper saying the beta function could never be negative in any field theory. We now understand the loophole in his argument. But fortunately for the rest of us, a hardy group of souls decided they were just going to continue and study the full range of field theories. And we now know in retrospect that that program was extremely successful and gave us, among other things, the dynamics of the standard model and many other fascinating field theories. The second lesson I'm going to take is that especially confinement and strong coupling was very difficult to tackle head on, and a very important role was played by taking certain simplifying limits. Okay, so 2D models, large N models, supersymmetric versions of QCD, all of these were crucial in our qualitative understanding of QCD. No one thought that these were literally the model of the real world, but they gave us a regime where we could actually see what was going on analytically and capture the behavior that was present. All right, so here's the strategy. I'm going to treat this as a Wolfsonian effective field theory problem. I'm just going to start with the degrees of freedom, which are the light degrees of freedom. I'm going to write down low-dimension interactions, coupling them. I'm going to integrate out high-energy modes and flow into the infrared and see what happens, and look for non-Fermi liquid behavior. So in this case, our low-energy degrees of freedom are the Fermi surface, as well as this massless order parameter field, and I'll couple them through the lowest dimension thing around, which is just a U-Kabel coupling. Okay? There's one other assumption I should state, which in high-energy physics would go without saying, but in this subject I think it's important to state as an assumption. That is, I'm only going to write down in the UV a local action and integrate out high-energy modes. So in particular, I'm not going to add anything like the following term, which would be non-local. It may actually be that in some cases this would be a good starting point, but it's not the starting point that I'm going to take. Okay. All right, so you can think of what I'm doing as taking Landau's two great frameworks and marrying them together, Landau Fermi liquid theory and Landau Ginzburg theory. Okay. You can think of it as the marriage between these two theories, or if you like, you can think of it as the titanic struggle between them. It's well known that those two things are the same thing. So why is it a titanic struggle between these two guys. So one way to think about this is we have, on the one hand, the bosons are trying to renormalize the fermions, while simultaneously the fermions are trying to renormalize the bosons. Okay, and the question is, which of these wins? Okay, so I'm going to go through each of these processes and discuss a little bit of the physics, and then I'll talk about different ways you can try and answer this question. All right, so let me talk first about how the fermions renormalize the boson. This is what's known as Landau damping. It's just a one-loop contribution to the boson self-energy. And the way I like to think of this is as a non-analytic mass term. Okay, that is, this one-loop diagram has is dimension mass squared times some non-analytic function of frequency and momentum. And the reason I like to think of it as a mass term is that makes it sort of intuitively clear that at very high energies, this is a tiny effect. But at sufficiently low energies, energies much below m, this becomes a big effect. And this one-loop contribution eventually dominates over the tree-level self-energy. Once that happens, you can think of it as this sort of being strongly coupled in the sense that a one-loop diagram is bigger than the tree-level diagram. Simultaneously, a two-loop diagram is bigger than one loop, and so on. Okay. So a lot of this talk is going to be strategies to try and push this contribution as low as possible so that the perturbative description remains valid, and we don't have to deal with these large loop contributions. All right, now the second side of the story is the bosons renormalizing the fermions. This is much more familiar from a particle physicist's point of view, because this is just logarithmic renormalization of the wave function. And so this does something we're very comfortable with it, which is that the logarithmically divergent piece gives some change in the scaling of the fermionic field. Okay. So these are the two competing effects. And the question of them is, which one of them wins out, or is there some compromise between them? So I should mention, there's a standard philosophy in the literature for what you're supposed to say, which is that the fermions win. Okay, so here the idea is you're supposed to keep one PI diagrams, but drop all the others at leading order, resum them up into a new boson propagator, and then eventually feed this back into the fermion, into loops correcting the fermion. Okay, and the idea behind this is you think that this is really capturing the dominant dynamics. So there's a very long line of work in this direction, going back to Hertz and Millis, and then more recently there's been a lot of interesting work by various people, including Chivikov, Sunsik Lee, and especially Max Metlitsky and Subir Sachdev. This is very interesting work. It's possible that this really is capturing the dynamics which are controlling what's going on in many or most of the materials we're interested in. But it's also possible that there may be some set of materials where a different set of dynamics is controlling what's going on. And I think it's good to explore more generally what could be going on. In any case, this is not the approach that we'll be taking. So I'll go in a different direction. My strategy is going to be start in the UV just by perturbing around the free theory. And I want to look for limits where the perturbative calculation is always reliable. Okay, so corrections to this don't become large in the regime that I'm interested in. And in particular, I'm going to look for small parameters, control parameters that I can take to be small, and look for intermediate regimes which are governed by approximate fixed points. I'm going to estimate the scales where this approach in perturbation theory eventually breaks down, where the corrections in perturbation theory eventually becomes large. In some special cases, we can push the scale where they become large all the way down to zero. But even if we can't, in theories where there are superconducting instabilities, it might not be so important to push them all the way down to zero. We just need to push the regime of control down to below where the superconductivity takes over. Okay? So this is the basic strategy. All right, so what types of parameters are there to dial? There are several in the theory. The two I'm going to focus on today are the dimension of space and a certain large n limit, okay, where we increase the number of fermions or bosons. All right? So let me talk first about dialing the dimension. So in this case, we gain some control because of a nice coincidence that happens among the different couplings in the theory. In particular, all of the interactions we have turn out to be classically marginal right around three spatial dimensions. All right, so we have a Yukawa coupling the boson and the fermions. We have a quartic for the boson. We also have a four Fermi interaction. All right, and by going through this type of scaling that I showed you in the first few slides, you can see that starting in the UV, these are all classically marginal right around three spatial dimensions. All right, so this means by doing epsilon expansion, we'll be able to find places at small coupling where the RGE equations or the beta functions vanish. All right, the second parameter that I'm going to dial to gain additional control is a certain large N limit of the theory. Okay, and so I'm going to be specifically focused on the following, where I have a large number of bosons. So to be more precise, I'm going to introduce an SUN boson symmetry in the theory. The boson is going to be matrix valued. It's going to transform in the adjoint of this theory. So there are essentially n squared of them. The fermions are going to transform in the fundamental. So there are only n of them. And so there are way more bosons than there are fermions. And the reason why this is nice is because you can see that this sort of intuitively is going to give you an immediate answer to this question of which of these two wins. We just have so many bosons here that they easily destroy, they easily defeat the handful of fermions that we have. All right. So the more technical way of saying that is Landau damping in this large n limit is a non-planar diagram. So in the limit that n goes to infinity, there's just no Landau damping at all. And here's a picture from a newspaper clipping. You probably didn't know, but among his many other accomplishments, Satchin Deboche was an amateur shark wrestler. All right, so what about the large n limit for the bosons? So when you take this matrix value limit of the boson, you now have actually two quartics you can write down, one which is a double trace and one which is a single trace. And it's important for simplicity theory to set this one to zero. The single trace can be set to zero in a sense, in a technically natural sense, in the sense of a tuft, since there's an emergent symmetry that arises when you set this guy to zero, namely there's an SON squared symmetry. And this, in fact, this SON squared symmetry is actually the fact that with only this guy, the boson sector is isomorphic to large N Wilson-Fisher fixed point with N squared degrees of freedom. Okay. So one thing that's nice about this is large N Wilson-Fisher is exactly solvable. So you know exactly what happens for the bosons. This is an analysis which is probably familiar to all of you. You compute the one loop contribution to the boson quartic term. Yeah.
Is there any reason not to just take it to be in the vector, and then you wouldn't even have to worry about this other term and take a large n vector limit?
Yeah, there is a reason. It's because we wanted to couple it to the bosons, I mean to the fermions in this matrix value way. Okay. All right. So we also have an additional contribution from the fermions, but this is suppressed both because of the kinematics of the Fermi surface, there's no log divergence here, and also it's a non-planar diagram, so at large n, this is zero anyway. Okay, so the bosonic sector is just described by the Wilson-Fisher fixed point.
Sorry, does the coupling to the fermions preserve that SON squared symmetry?
No, it doesn't. So there's a...
So it generates a quartic trace.
Well, it doesn't. So the reason is... Twofold is because, first of all, there are no log divergences arising, right? So this is the interaction that we give it. So it doesn't, and then also it's a non-planar diagram anyway. So you can, yeah. You can sort of think of it almost like a soft breaking of the symmetry. All right, so this is just the standard argument. You get a fixed point at below four dimensions in Wilson fixture. There's some contribution from the classical scaling dimension of the interaction, which drives it to be larger in the infrared. then there's some loop correction which drives it to be smaller, and those guys balance each other at some value of the coupling. All right. All right, so that's all familiar to us from our study of the Wilson-Fisher model, but what about the fermion? So this is where things start to get interesting. So I'm going to look at mainly the self-energy contributions to the fermion. One important point I wanted to mention before I move on is, so far we've been linearizing the dispersion relation for the fermions. So we're keeping just the linear term in the, so L here is, again, it's the normal component of a momentum, the distance from exactly the Fermi surface. And so this is, since this is lower dimensional than this, it should dominate low energies. But there are these higher dimensional terms, which start off small, but it'll be a sort of important to think of them as really being there. And we can keep as many of them as we want by being more going to higher orders and dimensions of operators. All right. So what happens when we compute the boson correction to the fermion self-energy? We get something which, as I mentioned, is logarithmically divergent. There's a log divergence that's proportional to frequency and one that's proportional to momentum. These two coefficients don't have to be the same. In fact, generically, they won't be. So this term gives you an anomalous dimension, changes the scaling of the fermions. When in Z sub L is different, and you also, in addition to that, you have some running of the fermion velocity. Okay, so there's some beta function for the velocity, and it looks roughly like this. So it's approximately constant. So what that means is that small values of the velocity, you get just this shift. All right, so velocity flows towards zero very quickly in this theory. All right, now let me talk about the renormalization of the vertex contribution. So one loop, there are two contributions, but actually, this vertex diagram is non-planar, so at large n, it just vanishes. So there's the other contribution, which just comes from the anomalous dimension of the fermions that we just discussed. And so this gives us some beta function for the Yukawa coupling. And again, we get some fixed point where the classical scaling dimension balances against the one loop correction. Okay. At large n, we can actually be more precise, due to the fact that all of this running is coming from the anomalous dimension. So we can, at infinite n, we can write down the beta function in this form, which is exact. And so you see that the anomalous dimension is exactly related to epsilon over 2. Epsilon is the distance from three spatial dimensions. So we have the following relation. The anomalous dimension is exactly epsilon over 2. And at large n, this is valid even away from small epsilon. So this allows us to take epsilon to be, say, 1, go to 2 spatial dimensions, and get large anomalous dimensions while the theory is still under control. Okay, and so by sort of a simple application of Kalin-Simancic, we then see that the fermion Green's function has to take the following form. All right. So this is something that's now characteristic of a non-Fermi liquid. We've now dressed up these fermions, and they no longer act like weakly coupled quasi-particles. One thing that just scaling doesn't tell us is about this residual function, which is sort of a scaling function, which is an arbitrary function of frequency over momentum. Obviously, this thing would never arise in a Lorentz invariant theory, because the way frequency and momentum come together is constrained by Lorentz invariants. But in these theories, we don't have Lorentz invariants, and so this is something which can, in fact, be there. Fortunately, we also have a few other tools at large n. In particular, we have a gap equation. This is an integral equation that arises from the fact that all of the fermion self-energy corrections are just rainbow diagrams. Okay, and so this is an integral equation relating the 1 pi contribution to the self-energy to a loop involving the full propagator. Okay, and this is the type of thing that shows up in various examples. The first time I'm aware of it being used is in the Atuft model. It also is used in some of the work that Ofer and Aharoni and Strauss-Manuel have been doing in 2 plus 1 dimensions. But it's nice. It's an integral equation. We can actually just solve it, and we can find exactly what the scaling function is. And it turns out that it's just a constant. Okay, so we have a Green's function that looks exactly like this. So notice there's only dependence on frequency at this point. All right? Yeah. All right. So one last thing I want to mention about the RG equations. So we're also interested in the four fermion interactions. So far, I've set this in the UV to be small. And there are diagrams which generate it from exchanging bosons, but all of these are non-planar diagrams. And so the only contribution to the four Fermi running is from wave function renormalization. And so at small values of the quartic, this will actually be stabilized. So this is always going to be driven towards the origin. And sort of the intuitive way of thinking about this is you've increased the dimension of the fermion due to the interaction with the bosons. So the quartic interactions now go from being marginal to essentially being irrelevant interactions. Okay, so they'll all be stabilized, at least around the origin. Okay, so there are no superconductivity instabilities in the infinite end limit if we start around this point. All right, so here's the summary. And so the intuitive point, we have what we've done is there's a scale where Landau damping corrections become large. By taking this large end limit, we've pushed this to a very low scale. At infinite n, this goes all the way down to zero. And at intermediate regimes, before we get down to the scale where Landau damping becomes large, we have Wilson-Fischer, a boson described by the Wilson-Fischer fixed point coupled to a Dress non-Fermi liquid.
So you said side of the fourth is irrelevant. You know you don't generate non-local. You have like side of the fourth is some funny omega dependence out the front due to exchanging
Well, you will, in fact. In fact, they will be down by powers of n. So they'll set in at a lower scale generally than Landau damping does because there are more powers of the, at weak coupling, because there are more powers of the coupling. So they have the same number of powers of n, more powers of the coupling. But indeed, once you hit this scale, shortly afterwards you'll hit contributions to the quartic from fermion loops as well, and those will be. There's no reason why those have to be local. All right. So I've talked a lot about this large end limit. Let me say one word about an obvious different large end limit you can take where you have a large number of fermions. If you have a huge number of fermions, then obviously there are enough of these guys, they easily defeat the one puny boson. And so in this case, actually, the Hertz-Millis approach is exact. That is, all of these 1PI diagrams are the only planar diagrams. And so you really do, in a 1 over n expansion, just resum these guys up and use a new propagator. Okay. All right. So now I want to step back and talk sort of generally about this problem in a little more qualitatively physical terms. And one of the things that one would like to accomplish, and this has to do with the various scales in the problem and how you would like them to be ordered. So in the theory that I've been discussing, there's sort of three major scales. There's the scale where the Fermi liquid gets dressed up into a non-Fermi liquid. There's the scale where superconductivity sets in. And finally, there's this scale where Landau damping becomes important. And what we'd really like is to have a non-Fermi liquid, which then is unstable to superconductivity. Okay. And in particular, we want the scales to be ordered in this way. We want, first of all, to see a non-Fermi liquid. Then below that, we want to see superconductivity arise out of the non-Fermi liquid. And then we want Landau damping to happen at a very low scale so we can always ignore it. And I should mention there's been some very interesting work recently by Max and Subir and their collaborators emphasizing a similar point. Their approach is to take Landau damping in from the very beginning, so the scales would be ordered differently, Landau damping would be up here. But the qualitative point is basically the same, right? What we want is superconductivity coming out of a non-Fermi liquid, all right? And in the theory that I've shown you, that's not what happens, because as I mentioned, at large n, we have no superconductivity instability close to the origin. And so we actually have scales in this direction. So we have, first we get dressed up into non-Fermi liquid, then at some low scale suppressed by n, Landau damping becomes important. And then if n is large, then superconductivity never really sets in. And one way of thinking about this is, in the infinite n limit, those diagrams I showed you where the boson would generate the quartic are non-planar, and so they're completely suppressed. And so the beta function just looks like this. You have some anomalous dimension for the fermion quartic, and then you have the usual BCS one-loop interaction, one-loop diagram we talked about one go. And so this is what the beta function looks like. So now I'm zooming out a little bit, not just looking at the origin. And so you're driven towards the origin as long as you stay around here. Okay. That's, you're right. You're right. So in fact, yes. So this is yes. But at any rate, what's invariant is the fact that this is below this. Okay. All right. So the thing I want to mention is the boson's always generating a quartic for you, which is sort of close to the origin. So you only generate things which are in this regime, and then they get driven back towards zero. All right. So however, this suggests the following sort of ad hoc cheap solution. We can just go in by hand, put in a large attractive quartic. Okay, this is sort of the dog patched together that only its owner can love. But we go in by hand, we put in some large quartic, so just to set us out here, and then the usual BCS instability takes over. And now we get superconductivity happening at some scale, which is given by this arbitrary parameter. And now we get to exchange these two guys. Now we have a non-Fermi liquid, superconductivity coming out of a non-Fermi liquid, and then Landau damping is tiny the entire time. Okay.
Sorry, I'm a little confused, actually, about the non-Fermi liquid that you have looks really strange, vis-a-vis transport, for example, because the fermions don't move.
Oh, because so, if you go all the way to the fixed point, there's zero velocity.
You have a zero order problem, which is your non-Fermi liquid looks nothing like experiments. Not that the superconductivity and Landau damping are in the wrong order.
Well, so velocity flows to zero. So you're right, it's zero once you reach the fixed point. But if you start off with velocity a little bit away from zero, now it's going to be going to zero as you go into the infrared. Or equivalently, if you're tuning towards optimal doping, then you get running up until you get to the scale of the boson mass, and then you stop running. So as you get closer and closer to optimal doping, the velocity is going to get smaller and smaller. That's actually very qualitatively similar to what they see in experiments, which is the effective mass of the fermions does diverge as you get closer and closer to optimal doping. Right. So the point is, what you're talking about is, and maybe I should emphasize this more, that if you're already right at the fixed point, then what you're saying is true. But if there's no reason why in the UV you would just start off with all the parameters there. So if you start off away from that, what you're actually going to see is an effective mass, which is for the fermions, which is non-zero, and which gets larger and larger as you get tuned to optimal doping.
Are you really suggesting that transport looks reasonable in this model for small perturbations? Or you don't know?
Your concern is that...
I mean, what is the conductivity with some irrelevant operators added, like a small velocity?
Yeah, so actually, so I don't know the answer. I don't know that resistivity really actually agrees with what they've seen. Okay.
I mean, but is there even some scaling argument or anything that suggests that it would be linear, or is that just not going to happen?
I don't know the answer. Okay, so you have to do some analysis, which you want it to be something which is not described by quasi-particles, because the whole point is to get away from that. So you want it to be strong coupling. Then you have to do analysis in that regime. Maybe it's obvious to someone here what should happen, but I'm trying to get these aspects of it right first.
Okay. Question.
Yeah.
So isn't reordering the strength of creating that dog up there, isn't that the same as just defining the quantum criticality to be irrelevant?
No. So quantum criticality...
You made the superconductivity more robust than the Landau damping ad hoc.
Yeah.
So that's like just turning it back into a classical problem.
No, definitely not. So the quantum critical point is still changing the behavior of the Fermi liquid theory into non-Fermi liquid.
if you just examined the superconductivity, you wouldn't notice anything having to do with the non-Fermi link.
That aspect of the story is just like the standard case. I agree. Absolutely.
Can I ask a question about, I mean, and to what extent is this under control when you add in a, I mean, the whole point of the theory is that you start from essentially the free fixed point, but now you're going to start not from the free fixed point. So to what extent is this under control?
Oh, well, this guy doesn't have to be extremely large, right? So it's as under control as, so you're worried because I'm adding this guy in and it's not, this can still be a perturbative coupling. All right, but I completely agree with your point. The boson is not playing an important role in superconductivity, and what you want is the boson to be playing an essential role. So in that sense, this, you know, Franken dog I showed you is not actually giving us what we want. And so what you really want is an example where the contribution from the boson really is responsible for enhancing the scale of superconductivity. It's responsible for superconductivity, for the scale in some essential way, okay? So I just want to talk about this as sort of the general problem. This is one of the things you would like to accomplish. You want, and so there still remain several parameters in the theory, and then you can also take various modifications of the theory, which can be explored in order to try and find one where the boson is actually responsible for the enhancement in the scale of superconductivity, and so you get these scales. All right, this last line is probably controversial, but experiments seem to suggest that we actually should be able to get superconductivity arising out of a non-Fermi liquid, so that should give you hope that such a limit does exist. And so I think it's important to look for a theory that has those properties. All right. So this is the summary. Non-Fermi liquids, I think, are an exciting problem to work on. Despite the materials having been for a while now, we still don't know exactly what the theoretical description of them is. So there's been a lot of exciting work on this. Our particular approach has been to look for local effective field theories of the Fermi surface, coupled to light states, and trying to see if we can find any that have the dynamics we're looking for. Okay. There are a number of parameters in the theory, in particular by taking large n limits. We can see them as sort of living in a larger space of different models with very different behaviors in some limits, say large nf versus large n boson. And in some specific limits, specifically large n, the theory can be analyzed perturbatively and in some cases solved and leads to approximate new fixed points. So, thanks very much.
The nature of the fixed point that you already get. So actually how the scaling acts on the degrees of freedom. Because for the Fermi liquid, we were scaling energy and the deviation from the Fermi liquid.
Yeah.
For bosons, we scale the momentum in all directions.
Yeah.
So yeah, how these two are how they merge, how these two notions of scalings,
mm-hmm.
how they reconcile with fixed points. So I'm confused about that. So for fermions, you don't rescale all momentum, right? You rescale only the distance.
Mm-hmm. So what can I say? I don't think that there's any contradiction between them. I'm really just scaling them exactly as I said.
But there is no dilatation operator.
Oh yeah, well, you have to do it, yeah. So that's true. If you were to try and write down all this in position space, it would look very non-local. It's really only simple at all if you write it down in momentum space. Maybe what you're getting at is, you know, the interactions among, as you scale the boson to smaller and smaller momentum, it's going to be coupling fermions at closer and closer angles. So that doesn't change the way the fermions are scaling, but it does change the fact that if you're only allowing bosons in your theory with very tiny momentum, the interaction between them is only going to couple fermions at some angle. So in a sense, the interaction that you see between the fermions, they're sort of forgetting about fermions which are far, far away from them. Okay. But I wouldn't... That's essentially what happens. So this is your Fermi surface. Mm-hmm. You have a fermion here, fermion here. They're coupled by some boson. Mm-hmm. And this has some momentum coupling these two guys, which is proportional to the angle between them. And so as you integrate out the high momentum modes of the boson, you know, you this guy no longer talks to this guy anymore. And so, you know, the interaction forgets about them. But that doesn't change the way you scale the fields. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm repeating Sean's question, but what is the role of epsilon, small epsilon, in your large M boson?
You don't actually need it, but I find it very useful because it allows you to connect to, you can do both the epsilon expansion and large N, and you can do the RG equations. Since at large N you can just solve the theory, you can take epsilon as one, but I think it's, first of all, it's a check that the solution matches onto perturbation theory at small epsilon. Okay, so because you could worry, you know, there's some solution to the integral equation, you plugged it in, does that have anything to do with perturbation theory or not? And by taking large small epsilon, you can see that those two things match onto each other. And also, I personally find the RG equations more intuitive than some large N solution. And so by seeing, for example, yeah, I mean, it just gives you additional intuition and handles, but you don't need it.
So the physics is the same.
If epsilon is, okay, that's an interesting question. Yes and no. If epsilon is, there's sort of a qualitative difference between really tiny anomalous dimension when epsilon is extremely tiny and order one anomalous dimension, right? If epsilon is very small, the theory is sort of.
So you cannot solve the theory at epsilon for one.
We can.
But yeah. Is the behavior the same?
It's just the order one anomalous dimension. That's the main difference.
Which you can compute.
It's epsilon over two. You can get that either from the beta function that I showed you, or you can get it just from solving the gap equation at large N. You get the same answer. Yeah.
I have a small question. I don't know if this makes sense, but so when making RG with Fermi surface, it's a natural scale that is the Fermi momentum.
Yeah.
Shouldn't that like somehow modify the couplings of your theory?
Okay, that's a great question. And actually, it's very important to take that into account. So this is one of the sources of subtleties in doing the RG in this type of theory is you have to choose a scheme where you don't have K Fermi around, right? Because when you apply the Kalin semantic equation, you have to include scales and in particular you would worry about not just a scaling function of this form, but you could, in principle, have something, say, of this form as well. And so this is the Green's function for the fermions. So what you have to do is you have to choose a scheme where you also integrate out high momentum modes, so you don't see the Fermi surface anymore. Probably the simplest way of doing this is using dimensional regularization. Okay, and then you immediately remove K Fermi from the beta function, but you can also do it using momentum shells.
However, you somehow have to introduce the fact that the Fermi surface is compact, right? It's like
no, you don't actually. So this is one of the nice things about if you integrate out high momentum modes. So this relates to this question actually. If as far as the Yukawa's interaction is concerned, if you are in the infrared and you have integrated out all of the high momentum modes of the boson, you actually, you know, at very low energies, you really just see this little regime. So you only see nearby patches. Okay. Yeah.
This last thing that you said is sort of confusing because the Landau damping is generally proportional to the whole surface of the Fermi surface.
Yeah.
And if you are basically seeing only a tiny patch of the Fermi surface, aren't you losing the information in the Landau damping?
Yes. So for Landau damping, you need to include the entire Fermi surface. There is a qualitative difference between the following two diagrams. Okay. So if you have this diagram, at low energies, you start off, you know, you start off at some point on the Fermi surface, you're interchanging only small momentum bosons, and so you only see nearby guys. Okay. That's not true for this. Here, say I have some tiny momentum for the boson, right? Now, this guy is going to be able to, so as long as this is, so this momentum is very small, you're going to be able to produce particle hole pairs sort of anywhere around the entire Fermi surface, and you need to include all of them. Okay.
Because this should somehow modify the competition between large number of stimulus and large number of fermions, isn't it? Somehow the number of fermions will be somehow boosted by the area of the Fermi surface.
Yeah. So some people, there's some advantages to thinking of the Fermi surface as a large N. There are a lot of technical similarities there, but you can also just think of it as a kinematic enhancement. But that's why we took this large N limit, is because by increasing the number of bosons, we more than suppress this, right, to deal with that.
Okay, let's thank Liam again.